Millions across Victoria and New South Wales have now experienced months of gruelling lockdowns. But it's not just the loss of jobs and the social isolation that's getting many people down. We've also seen some really heavy-handed policing. To the extent that residents in Western and Southwestern Sydney, for example, report fines for taking the bins out without a mask, helicopters over their houses, and police checking their bags at supermarkets. In Melbourne, Indigenous people and new migrants have been heavily overrepresented amongst those fined for breaching health orders. Now, some on the left have been sort of cheerleading this tough response, but others, including us here at Solidarity, see paramilitary policing as both racist and a threat to civil liberties, and it's helping to push some into the arms of the anti-vaxxers. Today, I'm talking to Celeste Little, who has spoken out against heavy-handed policing. Celeste is an Arenda woman, a union activist, social commentator, and the Greens candidate for the federal seat of Cooper in the northern suburbs of Melbourne. You're listening to The Sound of Solidarity, brought to you by Solidarity, a revolutionary socialist group in Australia. And if you'd like to find out more about us, our website is solidarity.net.au. I'm David Glanz. I'm happily double-vaxxed, and I'm recording this episode on unceded Wurundjeri land in Naam, or Melbourne. Celeste, welcome.
Thank you for having me, David.
Pleasure. Now, you're a prolific tweeter, and you post some really good stuff. So I thought I would highlight some of your posts and ask you to take us through your thinking. So some of these are verbatim from your tweets. You wrote quite recently, "Look, I'm sure I have more, but I have said consistently that policing the crisis is not the way to go. You don't want fear and ignorance to spread. Then don't make it your default way of dealing with the crisis. Don't lock down towers. Don't fine human rights activists." What was your thinking behind that 280 characters?
It kind of, for me, started last year. So at the beginning of our second wave in Victoria, I did question measures that were taken in the first wave, but we kind of accepted those given that nobody had any idea what the COVID crisis would look like. But during the second wave, we had measures brought in that were really, really questionable by the government. And I saw people on the left cheering for these in ways that I found incredibly problematic. So when they were locking down postcodes during the second wave, for example, I noticed that a lot of those postcodes that they were locking down were working class areas. There were areas that were quite multicultural, that had high, you know, Indigenous populations, and that were people who were employed quite insecurely. So the virus was spreading through these communities because people were in insecure work, and if they, you know, it's all very well to tell people not to turn up to work when they don't have any real sort of safety net to fall back on. If they don't do a shift, then they don't get paid. We were seeing those communities get locked down, and then they locked down the public housing towers. Public housing towers are full of new migrants, particularly refugees. They're full of people who have absolutely no financial means whatsoever, long-term unemployed, people with addiction. What they were doing there was, you know, they only gave those people, I think it was 3 hours notice to get in their apartments and never leave them again for the next 2 weeks. And they also stationed police officers at every single level of those towers to ensure that people didn't leave their rooms. And that, to me, was a gross abuse of policing powers. There were other matters that sort of sprung up in amongst all of this where information about COVID and keeping safe and what people needed to do to ensure that they stayed healthy was only distributed in English, and it was left to to migrant activist groups to translate this material into a number of different languages so that people could access the information in a way that they understood best. So there was that. Sorry, this is a really long-winded answer, but it's complex, David. The other part of it for me was that a lot of the blame initially for the second wave fell on the Black Lives Matter rally. That turned out to be absolutely incorrect. We did have a COVID positive case, at least one within the crowd on that day, but there was no community transmission during the rally, and indeed the organisers had taken all lengths they could to ensure that people knew their responsibilities to each other during a human rights demonstration, and also had access to equipment to keep themselves safe, such as masks and hand sanitizer. They worked with Aboriginal health organisations to get all that equipment, and had a really strong network of marshals to ensure that people were distanced and that they were being respectful. When it came out 3 weeks later, after the blame being unfairly laid at the feet of Black activists in Melbourne for the second wave, that the second wave of COVID had actually leaked out of the government's neoliberal hotel quarantining measures from a bunch of underpaid, undertrained security guards who'd been, hired via WhatsApp and all sorts of dodgy measures. It really felt like a slap in the face. And then on top of all that, there was the curfew and the fact that the government, in order to contain the virus, imposed a measure that had absolutely nothing to do with public health whatsoever, but everything to do with policing. With the curfew, the more that it got investigated by the media, the more it became apparent that it was a shock and awe tactic rather than a health measure that the government had undertaken in order to ensure that the population was compliant. And shock and awe to the degree that not a single, like the chief health officer in Victoria hadn't requested it as a measure and didn't actually see its worth as a measure. The police themselves hadn't requested it. So it was about, rather than public health and education, it was about increasing community fear. And that to me is quite a dangerous thing. And I guess what I'm reflecting on a year down the track from that is the fact that some of these measures are back in again, despite them already being proven. And we've still got those cheerleaders not questioning things. And I find that really dangerous.
Yes, I was very proud to be on that Black Lives Matter rally that you talk about. And I remember looking around and just seeing a sea of masks at a time when it was not compulsory to wear masks outdoors. Yeah. And all of us took our welfare and the welfare of others on that rally very seriously. And it's the hypocrisy from coming from the government and public health people. They keep on telling us that outdoors is safest. Brett Sutton has said many, many times, the chief health officer, it's 20 times safer outdoors than indoors. But apparently if you go outdoors and you want to protest, that becomes dangerous. It really shows how little priority that they're giving to the right to protest.
It falls on a backdrop too of a continued attack. So on the right to protest in Victoria. So you mentioned the masks and everyone wearing them at the Black Lives Matter rally, David. It occurred to me a long time ago that when we were all wearing the masks at that rally, we were adhering to the law whilst also breaking the law, because Victoria has had anti-mask laws at rallies in for a few years. It's quite an astonishing situation.
Yes, I'm pleased that somebody else had thought of that, because I've often had a chuckle about it. Another tweet you've posted much, I think even more recently, is, I suspect it's in the light of the protest this week, I am still completely unsupportive of this Victorian government continually escalating policing powers and cops firing assault weaponry at protesters. Take us through your thinking on that one.
So this is also probably a long answer, thought train. But as I said before, I have noticed that the Andrews government is very fond of policing, is very fond of prisons, has been escalating the powers of police prior to any sort of COVID pandemic anyway. And there was a couple of years ago now, coverage on the fact that these special ops police now had access to an entire arsenal of new weaponry, assault weaponry. So my thought with that starts with the fact that I've been involved in particularly the Indigenous rights space for a long time, but obviously I'm a continual protester, whether I'm engaged in the union movement or in feminist rallies or in anti-fascist rallies or whatever else. I've been out to a variety of different protest actions in this city. And it's always struck me that whenever we have a race rights rally in this country, in this city, whether it's Indigenous rights or it's refugee rights, you'll see the attendance of the SWAT teams, the special operations teams, with their weaponry standing there ready to act, in a way that they also will attend anti-fascist rallies. But I've been told by police liaison officers that this is actually the default, that, you know, it's normal for these officers to attend. But I haven't witnessed these same officers turning up to union rallies, big, you know, union sort of actions. I think it was telling that we were seeing these officers at the anti-lockdown protests. We were seeing them discharge assault weapons, so everything from pepper pellets, rubber pellets to capsicum spray grenades. Yeah, we were seeing these dispersed into a crowd, and these are assault weapons that are being shot at people who are gathering to protest. What occurred to me was that there were a bunch of lefties cheering, well, alleged sort of lefties, probably more moderates, cheering on these sorts of measures, and the right to shoot these weapons at these types of people that they didn't like. But it hadn't occurred to them that these same officers turn up to all these other rallies with these same weapons, and now they've just been given a free pass by a section of the community and by the state government to utilise them wherever they feel is appropriate. That's terrifying.
So are you worried that what we've seen over the last week or so in particular, a whole range of those weapons being deployed for the first time, do you think that's going to become the default process for the cops, and that all sorts of progressive protesters run the risk of being shot at in the way that we've seen this week down the track? Do you think a line's been crossed?
Yeah, I do. And I think that we really need to be on guard to ensure that that these sorts of special policing measures that we're told are essential for managing the COVID pandemic are wound back, you know, the minute that this pandemic looks like it's less of a threat in the community. Otherwise, we will see these same sorts of weapons being fired into Invasion Day protests, because the police, those special police are already there in great numbers. We'll see them turn up to all sorts of different rallies on the left. And we will see these abuses of power. I don't have a lot of faith that the state government is going to wind back these increased policing powers that they've brought in during this time, because the history prior to the pandemic states that as I said earlier, Andrews is very, very keen on increasing policing powers in the community.
Some people have not been very sympathetic this week to those who are being shot at, because the protests this week in Melbourne have been regarded as protests of the far right, of anti-vaxxers and conspiracy theorists. And obviously it's important, before we discuss this, to put on the record that I'm double vaxxed. I'm absolutely confident that you're double vaxxed, and that probably everybody we know is either double vaxxed or well on the way. And vaccinations are clearly safe and effective, and we want as many people as possible to be vaccinated. But having said that, there's obviously a problem when the state and the employer takes the power onto themselves to tell people how they will behave, especially around questions of health. And the construction unions, all the unions in construction, the Metal Workers Union, the AMWU, the Rail and Tram Union, the RTBU, have all come out and said they are absolutely for vaccination, but they're against vaccine mandates, and that they're counterproductive, and that they push people in the wrong direction, and that those who are hesitant should be talked to, should be encouraged and taken on a journey through to vaccination. What's your view on that?
I absolutely think that people should be taken through the journey and should be educated about vaccinations. And I think that the unions have a really incredibly important role to play within that. You know, whether it's educating members on COVID as a work health and safety issue, like, you know, you get one infection in a construction site and that rips through an entire site, all of a sudden you don't have a workforce. So it is a work health and safety issue. Ensuring people have the right information is incredibly important, particularly when there is such a misinformation campaign. And to an extent, I believe that our governments have allowed that to happen, particularly with regards to, you know, the AstraZeneca shots and the likelihood of blood clots. When weighed up against the likelihood of blood clots from COVID itself, or from smoking, or from taking the pill, or whatever else. I also think too that when a workforce does feel a bit under siege, and a lot of the members within the CFMEU were feeling a bit like that, they'd already taken action, because tea rooms have been shut down because construction was representing 13% of the COVID cases in Victoria. When they're already feeling under siege, and there's anti-vaxxer groups and far-right groups that are looking for a mass of people to infiltrate and to spread misinformation and to organise, then it creates a perfect storm sort of situation. So I'm not surprised that that some within these industries have engaged with misinformation and have been engaged in these kinds of rallies. I think that not enough work has been done to ensure that people are educated enough on the vaccines, on the collective responsibility to community safety. They are looking for answers, particularly when, as we've already talked about, a lot of the COVID response in this state has been to police the crisis rather than to inform the public and ensure that the best information is out there, you know, as quickly as possible.
So do you think the vaccination mandate has, in that sense, backfired? Because in New South Wales, there is no vaccine mandate in construction, but there is a restriction on the number of workers on site if people don't have vaccination. And by all accounts, that's led to a significant uptake in vaccination. Do you think the mandate has just pushed people in the wrong direction?
I think it has, to an extent. I think the people were already feeling a bit under siege because they'd already had workplace rights restricted through the tea room stuff. And an opportunity to to properly engage with this group of workers and to educate. I mean, they could be rolling out COVID vaccines for those who choose to take them up on the sites, on and, you know, and lobbying for things like pay for those who feel ill effects or whatever else. But instead, it's just gone this hard line sort of, you must have rule by the government. And when you've already got a workplace that's feeling under siege, and there's all these other sort of societal rules that are playing out at the same time that are making a lot of people in the state who've lived under these continual lockdowns now for nearly 240 days feel quite stressed and oppressed and on edge. It's created an environment where a group of people are actually feeling picked on by the government, I believe, and are therefore exploitable by people peddling misinformation.
A number of my colleagues in both blue collar and white collar workplaces report that they have workmates who are good union members, anti-racists, basically on our side on all sorts of issues, but for whatever reason are either resistant or hesitant about getting vaccinated. For instance, comrades on the waterfront in Sydney report that there's quite a number of Indigenous workers and Pacific Island workers who are reluctant to get vaccinated because they don't trust the government. And I've even heard reports from within schools and universities amongst white collar workers of that being the case. We are potentially only a couple of weeks away from union members being sacked for not being vaccinated. How do you think the union movement should respond?
The union movement really needs to step up its education campaign on this. I mean, you were talking about a variety of workers. I work for a white collar union. I know that there's some within this highly educated group of members who are incredibly resistant to the vaccine. I also know that there's nurses out there who are anti-vax. I mean, it spreads through a whole bunch. Like there's members all over the country, I should say, in different unions who are anti-vaccination. I feel that the unions have a responsibility to start educating and doing outreach to members as much as possible with regards to COVID and the need to ensure that workplaces are safe. You know, without that sort of information, we are going to see continual sort of misinformation campaigns play out. It has been interesting in the Indigenous space. You mentioned vaccine hesitancy within Indigenous waterfront workers. I've seen that all along the coast and have been trying to personally rebuff those sorts of mentalities taking over in the community. But you can understand to a certain extent, why when there's an unacknowledged history in Australia of things like lock hospitals where Indigenous people were essentially medically tested upon or taken to in order to remove them from land under the guise of having some sort of a disease in the hope that we'd die out. Yeah, you can see why there'd be a mistrust, but changing that message is as simple as pointing out that a community like Wilcannia, which is a highly Indigenous community, has been completely neglected by the government to the point of where COVID has just ripped through that community and so many people ended up being sick. I believe it was about nearly a third of the town had been exposed to or had been ill. If there was any real sort of, you know, if the vaccines really were poison, if they really were, you know, more harmful than the disease itself, then I don't think in a settler colonial society where Australia has continually tried to erase the Indigenous population, that Indigenous people would be so neglected when it comes to vaccines. I think that we'd be the first ones to roll it out, to receive the rollout. Maybe I'm cynical, but that's how I've seen it play out. So I understand the hesitancy, but we've always got to ensure that people are getting the right information and that they can make informed choices and they do make choices for the benefit of the community.
Yeah, I think that suspicion is completely understandable. Obviously, people should get vaccinated, but I can understand why they're highly suspicious. And also, they've been ignored. In Solidarity magazine and on our website, we have an interview with two women from Wilcannia. And one of them, Monica Kerwin, told us, 12 months ago, I sat in meetings demanding that they prepare facilities for us to isolate, even tents, mattresses and sleeping bags. But when this outbreak happened and I asked for them to pull out the plans we'd tried to make, we looked back at the minutes and it didn't even note that I attended. And I think the dismissal and the cynicism and the overt or covert racism in that kind of experience makes people very suspicious. I'm not saying Monica's suspicious, but I can see why people in Wilcannia would interpret it that way. Which makes me wonder, there's sections of the left who are very gung-ho for compulsion and coercion when it comes to construction workers. They have to be vaccinated, and if they lose their jobs, tough bananas sort of thing. I wonder whether those same people are quite as gung-ho when it comes to enforcing vaccination in Indigenous communities. Because after all, we've seen the horrendous impact of the Northern Territory intervention, which was literally soldiers going into communities, supposedly to defend the children of those communities. And people are still living 10, 20 years on with the impact of that intervention, the loss of autonomy, the inability to actually get access to cash. So is that a warning signal to the left? Be careful what you wish for, because there are vulnerable people out there who are going to suffer if you go all the way with coercion.
Yeah, well, it should be in any case. I mean, you know, the intervention came in 2007, and I still have some family members living under it. We've said so many times in the Indigenous community that oppressive bad policies are often trialled upon our communities before they're rolled out to the broader public. And we're seeing that with the Inju card, because that started as the basics card. Suddenly, Gillard, through her reinstatement of the Racial Discrimination Act, which had to be suspended in order for Howard to bring in the intervention, opened up those sorts of intervention measures to non-Indigenous people, which only made 13% of the population the communities that she was dealing with anyway. So it was still a highly racist policy. But we're seeing the cashless debit card hit more and more communities. We're seeing things like the community development program and the 25 hours worth of work per week for the dole that some of these communities have been exposed to. We're seeing that touted for other groups of unemployed people. You know, a few years down the track, even though the government says that they're currently they're looking at dismantling this program and reinstating a new one that works with the communities. I think we have every right to be cynical about that. And we also have every right to look at these sorts of examples and wonder where they're going to hit next, because Indigenous people are often warning people, warning the broader community, that these things will end up in their backyards next, and that if they fail to act on them, that this is what's going to happen. These things become normalised. I guess the main thing is that the left also does need to be a little bit careful when it comes to characterising these sorts of anti-lockdown protests that we've seen as just being far-right actors or being you know, anti-vax nutters or whatever other sort of ableist language that people will use. Because prior to these activities that we've seen a lot of CFMEU members swept up in, we had seen anti-lockdown protests, and these protests were growing and growing. You know, more and more people were taking to the street, to the point of where one of my friends, who's a photojournalist, was noting that there was about 5,000 people taking to the street. And they're not just white fascists. They were people of all sorts of colours and creeds. I think that a lot of opportunities to talk about social policy and social safety net and ensuring people have secure jobs and access to excellent public health care and access to decent unemployment benefits if they do lose their jobs through this pandemic. A lot of that has been, that opportunity has been missed. And this is why we've seen a growth in the number of these sorts of events occurring and these sorts of communities being permeated. A lot of people are feeling really distressed right now. And the only way we're going to cure that distress is with stronger social approaches.
Okay, Celeste, thank you very much for your time. It's a public holiday here in Nam in Melbourne, and I've taken up a chunk of your afternoon, so I really appreciate it, and thank you.
No worries at all.